Hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much. My name is Tom Easton. I'm with The Economist magazine. This will be a very, very brief introduction. The first thing I have to say is that on a hot summer day when many people are either about to go on vacation or just coming back, it's just tremendously flattering to our host, to our speaker, and actually a great compliment to what people feel about him that they would show up today to hear this lunch. Before I say anything about him, I want you to know that I'm always told that on Thursday, I have to tell you about future lunches, John Greenwood is going to be speaking. He is considered one of the fathers of the PEG. He's one of the rare people who will come from overseas and have a huge Chinese audience. I think people are quite concerned about what he has to say about monetary policy. So if you're interested in it, you should contact the club. It will be a very well-attended lunch once again. Secondly, what I am told to say is please turn off your cell phones and your BlackBerries. If you see me reaching for mine, it's because it's the only way I can keep track of the time. The speaker, as will be our tradition, will speak for about 20 minutes. And then I really hope that you will ask very, very provocative and lively questions. This is an opportunity for the club and for all the people here, and we have a speaker from America, so they're used to taking very, very provocative questions, so please do not hold back. Your most striking or offensive comments about climate change, this is the place to ask them, and this is a speaker to ask them about. Now, I think we're all concerned about the role of China and the role of America in climate change. We're all concerned about issues of regulation. Is it sufficient? Is it excessive? Will the consequences be good? Will the consequences be bad? If we aren't directly concerned and have feelings about these issues already, we're confused about them. So we're very lucky today to have Jonathan Lash as our speaker. He's head of the World Resource Institute. He has tremendous experience both in government and also in NGOs and working with private enterprise to try to come up with interesting and reasonable ways of affecting what is unfolding in the world. So with that very, very brief comment, I pass this on to the speaker. 20 minutes, please save up your questions. Start raising your hands as soon as you like. I'll keep track of all of you, and I'll try to recognize all of you before this is over. Thank you.
So the last talk I gave on climate change a week ago in London, the master of ceremonies was a TV journalist. And when I finished, he started out, instead of asking for provocative questions, demonstrating. And his first question to me was, isn't it a fact, Mr. Lash, that the legislation that recently passed in the United States is a fraud perpetrated on the world and the American people by people like you? That got us going. I really am very pleased to be with you this afternoon. When we set up this occasion and I said that I'd like to talk about the progress of climate change legislation, the legislation actually hadn't passed the House yet, and I was worried I was going to have to show up and explain to you why the United States didn't intend to do anything after all on climate, and it would be a sad lunch for you and a depressing moment for me. In fact, I can talk a little bit about the politics of what is happening and what I think will happen next and what some of the implications may be for our relationship with China and for businesses here. If I may, however, I'll take a moment first to talk a little bit about my organization, the World Resources Institute. We're a global environmental think tank. We try to turn ideas into action. We're a solutions-oriented organization that tries to provide analysis and policy ideas for solving the problems that are shaping our environmental future. We work in four areas: climate change, ecosystems and ecosystem services, sustainable enterprise, using markets to solve environmental problems, and environmental democracy, assuring people that people get information and the right to participate in decisions that affect them. I'll give you a couple of illustrations. We developed with the World Business Council on Sustainable Development the basic accounting tools that are used for determining greenhouse gas emissions at a firm level. So if you work for a major manufacturing firm that reports its greenhouse gas emissions, they use these accounting processes to determine what the level of emissions is. We set out to do this because we thought governments should, and we just wanted to demonstrate it, that it could be done. It has become the accepted global standard, and we were invited a few years ago by the NDRC to do a demonstration project in China with several sections, several sectors here, and the NDRC has now applied that greenhouse gas accounting protocol to the cement sector. We've gone on to petrochemicals. It's important because in a world in which the trading of carbon emissions rights is going to become a significant business subject of tens of billions of dollars investing, assuring that a ton is the same thing in New York and Beijing is just as important as assuring that a reported profit or loss means the same thing in both places. We also have done extensive work tracking the loss of global forests. And one of the compelling problems that's affecting forests today is illegal logging. In many of the world's most important forests, more wood is taken illegally than legally. That is an issue both for the protection of the integrity of the forests themselves and for climate change, since deforestation is the source of about 16% of greenhouse gas emissions. There was a recent change in law in the United States that applies our endangered species laws to trees and allows prosecution of anyone who imports illegally harvested wood. We have begun to work with the government and a number of private users to use satellites to provide the basis for the prosecution of those who illegally import wood. And this is just a demonstration of what the satellites can do, right? This is the same technology that's used by the military for tracking tanks in the desert. This is a picture of a forest in Cameroon. The road marked in red shouldn't be there because this area has not been open to forestry. The little red spot down below is where a single tree has been illegally harvested. You can see the path along which that tree was hauled to the illegal road. The illegal road leads to one French logging company that claims that they never accept illegally harvested wood. On the basis of this kind of evidence, prosecution becomes possible. So when a container ship, including illegally harvested wood, arrives in the port of Los Angeles, sometime in the next 6 months, you'll see stories about a seizure of a container ship containing wood. And when that happens, we're working with a number of big companies who are wood buyers who will give assurance that they will never purchase from suppliers of illegally harvested wood, which we hope will send a signal up the supply chain and change practices in places like this so that no more wood is hauled along that pathway to that French company. One more example of what we do, and then I'll get to climate change. We have found that some of the most creative and powerful ideas for dealing with environmental problems come from small-scale entrepreneurs who have a passion to develop environmental solutions and want to turn them into businesses. We began trying to identify those entrepreneurs first in Latin America, now in China, and to provide them mentoring, business assistance, and ultimately connect them with investors. It's now about 150 companies that we've worked with, moving about $170 million, and by far our strongest program is in China. On Friday, I will speak at our latest investors forum. I'll be joined by the CEO of a wonderful company that was one of our companies a few years ago, Sinentech, which has developed a technology for reducing waste, which is reducing CO2 emissions, water pollution, and saving money for the companies it works with. So on to climate change. And I actually hope that I'll get back to the subject of these entrepreneurs because I think they're the solution. This is just a temperature graph. Each of the colored lines is an average temperature track over a shorter and shorter period of time. As you see, each of the lines, as it gets shorter, is steeper because the temperature rise has been going more quickly. I'm not going to go through a whole science presentation. I actually think the science is over. But I want to communicate one message as the background for everything else I say. The buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is going far faster than any of us predicted 10 or 15 years ago. And the impact on temperature is going more quickly than any of the models predicted 10 years ago, because the models were all designed to be conservative. And the impact of that temperature rise on everything from rainfall patterns to the melting of polar ice to sea level increases is all going faster than anyone would have dared to predict even a decade ago. We're now beginning to see positive feedback mechanisms where climate change is causing physical phenomena that accelerate climate change, like the melting of the polar sea ice, which means that reflective white ice is replaced by dark blue ocean, which absorbs heat. Everything we see today is the product of 0.8 degrees of warming, 0.8 of a degree centigrade of warming. Even if environmentalists had their way and everything which we hope might happen happens in upcoming negotiations and the world reduces its emissions as quickly as anyone believes possible, we'll still face 2 degrees of warming, 2.5 times what we've already experienced. So that's the background for this discussion, which will now move to a much more political set of issues. I don't know what the atmosphere is here, but in the U.S., people are still completely obsessed with the economic crisis. It is concern number one, concern number two, and concern number three. In much of the country, jobs are the only issue, and environment is not at the top of the agenda. And even so, legislation to deal with climate change is moving ahead in the U.S. That is partly a consequence of the fact that President Obama has been absolutely consistent in his commitment to action on climate change. He takes the same position now that he did during the campaign, asking for national mandatory legislation to reduce emissions. It is partly a consequence of the fact that things have not actually been quite so inactive in the U.S. as you might think from the outside. There are 22 states who now have their own cap and trade programs either underway or in planning. Those states represent more than 50% of the economy, which means that individual jurisdictions are proceeding to control industrial emissions even though there's no national plan, a completely inefficient and chaotic approach which is driving business crazy and is intended to do exactly that. There are 884 cities that have their own climate plans, cities that are taking measures to reduce emissions, to become more efficient in their use of energy. And now there's a group of 26 major U.S. companies joined by 5 NGOs, which the chairman of GE, Jeff Immelt, and I played a major role in convening, who have endorsed mandatory national cap-and-trade legislation to reduce U.S. emissions by 80%. I have to say this is a totally changed dynamic. I've been working on environmental issues for 30 years. I've been involved in dozens of legislative fights, and The dynamic was always like this. The public was frightened and demanded action. Industry opposed action. And ultimately, the Congress adopted legislation by big bipartisan majorities over the objections of industry. Now, actually, the public isn't thinking about it much. They're thinking about jobs and the economy. My closest allies in working on these issues are big companies. I talk to Jeff Immelt more often than I do to the head of the Sierra Club, and the issue has become highly partisan in the Congress. That means that all of our experience about how these issues move is a little bit irrelevant, and something unusual is going on. The companies are interested, I believe, for two reasons. First, of course, they want to influence this legislation. If it's going to pass, they'd like to help write it. So they say, if you aren't sitting at the table to write the legislation, you're likely to be on the table getting cut up for dinner. And they feel that by affirmatively acting to support legislation, they can have more influence. But there's a second, more important reason, which is they find uncertainty to be extremely costly. They know they're going to face a carbon-constrained economy. They know they will deal with new markets, but they're not sure when or what it will look like, and that's expensive for them. Frankly, they want to begin the competition for the green markets of tomorrow as soon as possible, and in order to do so, they want carbon constraints within the U.S. economy to become clear. So here's what passed the House narrowly 3 weeks ago. It includes a target that would reduce U.S. emissions 17% by 2020 and about 83% by 2050. It includes a mandate for 15% of electricity to be from renewable sources or efficiency by 2020. It includes nationalization of building energy efficiency standards. It includes provisions that allow companies that are regulated under the carbon cap to purchase offsets from entities outside the regulation. I'll come back to that because it would allow them, for instance, to purchase carbon credits from Chinese companies. It sets very stringent standards for the construction of new coal-fired power plants. They would have to be 50% more carbon efficient, produce 50% less carbon per unit of electricity before 2015, and 65% more efficient by 2020. That essentially means it requires carbon capture and storage. And finally, there are trade provisions which begin by allowing the government to provide impact assistance to carbon-intensive industries that face competition from companies in countries that are not regulating carbon, and ultimately in 2020 would allow the president to impose a border carbon adjustment, a requirement that companies purchase carbon permits to import carbon-intensive goods into the U.S. by 2020. As I was saying to one of my neighbors at lunch, it's not absolutely clear to me that's WTO compliant, but it's a clear indication of which direction the politics are going in the U.S. Okay, this is the wonkiest part of this whole talk, but bear with me. This is a graph showing the CO2 reductions that would be accomplished by the legislation that was passed. The red line on top is what would happen without any legislation, and the set of colored lines going down are what would happen with the legislation. I'm not going to talk about the distinctions between the different lines, but we can talk about that later if you want to. But this legislation is different than any other piece of environmental legislation I've ever experienced. Everything I've dealt with before has essentially set a single endpoint, right? You put this machine on your smokestack, you're done. You've complied, we're finished. This doesn't apply to one smokestack, and it doesn't set one endpoint. It says, we're putting a cap over the entire economy, and we're going to reduce emissions over a period of 40 years more and more deeply. We haven't ever dealt with that kind of roadmap legislation before, which undertakes a long process of change, and I don't believe we fully understand how deeply that will affect investment and innovation in the U.S. It's not so much what the cost of carbon is going to be 5 years from now, it's the prospect of how markets are going to be changed over a period of 25, 30, and 40 years. I think it's profoundly important. I was at a meeting with my friend Chad Holliday, the chairman of DuPont, who was asked by a reporter who was deeply skeptical of why DuPont would be supporting this legislation. Well, if the president signed this bill today, what would you do differently tomorrow? And Chad said the following. He said, first of all, last week I canceled construction on a new thin film solar plant that we're building. It's a terrific technology, but I had to cut something, and I don't know when there's going to be a market for its products. He said, if the president signs the bill today, I start construction again tomorrow because I know there's going to be a market, and we think this is a winning product. Secondly, we spend about $100 million a year in research on advanced biofuels, on cellulosic technologies. He said, if the president signs the bill today, I'll double that tomorrow to $200 million because I know there's a market and I want to capture it before somebody else does. It's that that I think will cause change, not the regulations themselves. Prospects in the U.S. Senate are difficult. A brief explanation of civics. While our House has each member representing a certain number of people, in the Senate, each state has two senators. So my former state of Vermont has two senators, even though it has a population of only 600,000, and California, with 40 million, also has two senators. The consequence is senators represent geography, not people. That was actually put in our Constitution because the southern states wanted to protect slavery. We're past that, but now we're into protecting coal. There's a group of Democratic senators from the old industrial states in the Midwest that are coal dependent who have said we're only prepared to vote for climate change legislation if it protects our industry and our consumers. They're from places where coal is more than 60% of the electricity mix and where coal is relatively cheap. So as Europe had to deal with Poland before they could reach agreement back in December, we have to deal with Indiana and its neighbors. Okay, a couple of remarks on the interaction with China, and then I'll wrap up and we can discuss what all this means. As I said, the legislation provides for the purchase of international, up to a billion tons a year of international offsets. If you assume that carbon prices in the U.S. Will get up to around $20 a ton, that's $20 billion a year, roughly, of demand for international offsets. A big part of that will come from avoided deforestation, probably, but it creates a tremendous opportunity for firms in Asia that choose to reduce emissions to sell credits from those emissions reductions. It adds an additional incentive to something which probably pays for itself anyway. It will also create enormous technology demand in the U.S. For solar, wind technologies, efficiency technologies, geothermal, in which China has made clear indications it wants to become a leading vendor. That competition, if this legislation passes, will become white hot. I think that would be terrific. I think that's what leads to a solution to this problem. As soon as the U.S. passes legislation, we immediately have an intense interest in a successful international negotiation, right? Two reasons. First, what we do won't solve the problem unless there's an international agreement so all nations participate, and second, we want a level carbon playing field. We don't want carbon leakage going from areas of the world that are regulating to areas of the world that are not. There's intense fear among U.S. politicians about carbon leakage and job losses. And that can be addressed by successful negotiation. We need to get that agreement before the protectionist tendencies that were reflected in the bill make it more difficult for us to reach agreement. And to be perfectly honest, it's not just in this bill we've seen protectionism. All of us had protectionist provisions in our stimulus legislation. The U.S. has Buy American, but Chinese has Buy Chinese as well. I think the issue we face is not a scientific issue. It's an issue of political will. All of our leaders acknowledge that climate change is a real problem, but they all hesitate over who should go first in moving toward the carbon-constrained economy and whether they really believe that low-carbon development is possible. Thank you.
Well, that was great. I, of course, just have one question, which is, don't you think it's a fraud? But I welcome any of you following in that line of thought. So, yes, this person over here. Thank you very much. Please give your name and whatever affiliation you might have.
Okay. My name is Matsunaga, Daisuke Matsunaga. I'm the deputy CG of Japan. I used to be a climate change negotiator, but I may be outdated. My knowledge may be outdated. So if I remember correctly, there used to be a Senate resolution called Byrd-Hagel resolution, which basically states that unless India and China take on commitments to reduce emissions, the United States is not going to take on its own any commitments. And the new legislation, does it basically override that Senate resolution? I think this question directly relates to who goes first, who makes compromises. There's one more. Okay. The industrial, the new legislation covers the industrial industry's commitments to reduce emissions, cap and trade. But it's not the only industries that emit gases, but households, governments, and individual drivers also emit gases. How does it relate to the overall national American reduction targets?
Good. With regard to the so-called Byrd-Hagel resolution, which, as the questioner said, was a non-binding instruction from the United States Senate to our government not to negotiate an agreement unless China and India agreed to participate, yes, this legislation would essentially override that. And interestingly, that group of companies that I mentioned, the United States Climate Action Partnership, explicitly urged that the U.S. pass legislation regardless of whether other countries take action because they actually see it to our benefit to decarbonize the economy. But there is tremendous political pressure for reassurance that the whole world will enter into any agreement. I don't think that it necessarily means that the commitments from China, India, Brazil, South Africa have to be the same as commitments from the industrialized countries. They don't have to be caps. They have to be commitments to action. And that's what was embodied in the negotiating roadmap adopted by all countries 2 years ago at Bali. The second question was, how do we cover the parts of our emissions footprint that are not industrial emissions? 83% of U.S. emissions are covered. Many of them are covered upstream. So instead of requiring every driver to purchase a permit for the CO2 emissions from her car, the emissions requirements are applied at the refinery level. But virtually all of the emissions are covered.
I'm going to work my way, if you don't mind, this way. But actually, I'll do it in order of who put up their hand first, and this man still wins over there. So make sure I see you, even if I don't call on you right away. I'm taking notes of wherever you might be.
My name is Jeff Vanderwalk. I'm at the Faculty of Law at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. You started your talk with the mention that 2 degrees centigrade is inevitable. There's nothing anybody can do about it. There's a famous scientist in England, James Lovelock, who's been focusing on this and the fact that what we should be focusing on, I mean, it's of course it's important to reduce emissions, but perhaps people think that if we reduce emissions, somehow the problem is solved, whereas in fact, we do have to deal with the effects of the inevitable. And should there be more focus on the political needs of adapting to those events that will be caused by the 2% rise in global temperatures?
So there are two discussions that arise out of the realization that no matter what we do, it's going to get warmer on Earth and quite rapidly. The first is the issue of adaptation. You know, the U.S. And Europe are going to figure out how to adapt. We have the resources and technology to do it. For instance, after the set of hurricanes, Katrina and the ones that followed, when companies that operate on the Gulf Coast rebuilt the plants and refineries that were affected by the hurricanes, they built everything on the assumption of a 20-foot flood surge, storm surge. But most of the world, and particularly the countries that will be affected first, don't have that capacity. So one of the absolute moral and political necessities for an international agreement will be some form of assistance from the wealthiest parts of the world to the poorest parts of the world for adaptation. The second thing that always comes up in this discussion is, shouldn't we proactively intervene in some way to offset warming? We talked about ocean fertilization a little bit at the head table during lunch. Should we be dumping fertilizer in the oceans in hopes that algae will grow that will suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere? Or maybe we should shoot up rockets full of particulates into space in order to create a cloud layer that will prevent warming. And I tell you, that just absolutely scares me. We're talking about rapidly trying to engineer a set of global changes that we don't understand to compensate for a global change that we've already created because we didn't understand. And that one doesn't appeal to me very much.
And then I'm, just to give you an agenda, I'm working my way back towards the center.
This is Dominic Yin, chairman of Hong Kong Association of Energy Service Companies, and also co-chair of China Committee of IPPF. Recently, we read in newspaper that Secretary Chu of DOE and Secretary Lak of DOC went to Beijing for 3 days. Obviously, they don't talk to each other to go voluntarily. Must be dispatched by Obama. What do you think the purpose of this visit, and how do China cooperate with U.S., not just talking, you know, how to do it together for our mutual benefits? And my next question, Hong Kong is part of China. We have smart people here. How do we get Hong Kong people to get involved in this mutual beneficial ideas? Thank you.
You saw that Secretary Chu announced a cooperative agreement to set up a joint center for research on energy efficiency in buildings, which I think is a wonderful initiative and very easy, right? I mean, that's the kind of cooperation that we can do that doesn't require much change on either side or even the development of any trust. The real question is whether we'll develop policy cooperation. I don't work for the government, so I don't have to be careful in what I say. I think there will be an international climate agreement if at some point President Hu and President Obama reach an understanding that what each one proposes to do is sufficient to the other one, and then the whole world will move. And if they can't do that, I think it will be very difficult to reach agreement. But I see all of the visits. So Secretary Clinton, her very first visit as Secretary of State was to China. The Speaker of the House, Mrs. Pelosi, has come. The Chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Kerry, has come. Secretary Chu, Secretary Locke. We're just sending a stream of top officials to China. I think those are all laying the groundwork of understanding. But my sense is until the U.S. is committed, until the U.S. adopts legislation, the next step isn't possible. That it isn't possible for President Hu and President Obama to reach that agreement. I like your question about Hong Kong very much. That's why I'm here. It is absolutely essential that business leaders, and particularly bankers, make the decision that those companies that I'm working with in the United States Climate Action Partnership have made, that tomorrow's markets are going to be carbon-constrained markets, and the competition of the future will be in the technologies that enable us to move forward and improve people's lives with less use of carbon. And I think Hong Kong does a tremendous amount to define what's possible and what's important and what's real business. I think this is real business. I hope that Hong Kong will become a source of that set of incentives.
Genevieve Hilton, over here.
Genevieve Hilton, BASF Chemical Company. I just had, I guess it's a technical question. You had one bullet point on their second to last slide about CCS, and I was wondering how much carbon capture and storage or sequestration actually figured into the whole mix. It was other than one small bullet point.
Right. Because coal is a compellingly important part of the problem for us as it is for China, assumptions about CCS went into everyone's calculations about what was possible and what it'll cost. There is no commercial scale CCS operating anywhere in the world, so we're all guessing about future technology. The assumption in this bill is that there will be significant investments in CCS and that all future coal will be based on some form of carbon capture and storage. I just didn't go into detail about all the incentives, but there are billions of dollars worth of incentives. That said, there still isn't any CCS demonstration under construction in the U.S., which I find hard to believe if we're serious about climate change.
Violating everything I said about priorities, I defer to my colleague Tom Holland to ask.
Jonathan, going back to what you said a moment ago, that what it'll take for a climate deal is for President Obama to get on the phone to President Hu or vice versa, and for them to agree something between them to drive an international deal. Now, looking back a couple of weeks ago, the Waxman-Markey bill is essentially promises to take the U.S. by 2020 back to the level of emissions in 1990, roughly. And the Chinese response to that was to demand, I think it was a 20% reduction from 1990 levels by 2020. That's a lot of ground to cover before they meet in the middle. Any ideas or any thoughts on just what a compromise deal might look like that might be eventually acceptable to both parties?
So the Chinese demand is entirely consistent with what Europe has been saying, and there was a recommendation in the last report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that suggested a path that would lead to reductions of 25 to 40% below 1990 levels by 2020, which is the origin of that request. The reason that I've gone back to my wonky chart is this does get us into the difference between the different lines. What the legislation actually does is the cap gets us to 4% below 1990 levels by 2020, so not sufficient. There are additional regulatory measures, which I would bore you to tears if I described, which will get us further than that. And in addition, there is funding for the U.S. to purchase 6 billion tons of avoided deforestation, forest offsets, by 2020. If you put all those things together, it actually puts us into that 20% below area. I think that ultimately the issue is not so much what we do by 2020 as the pathway we're on and the clarity of political will in the U.S. and generally that we're going to decarbonize. And the agreement will ultimately be formulated around that pathway.
Thank you.
Hi, Fergus O'Rourke from Mode 2. I'm a communication consultant focusing on sustainability. Look, my question, Jonathan, is whilst politicians and statesmen are attempting to agree, or you might say in parentheses, fiddling whilst Rome burns, what role do you see for buyer mandates to the supply chain? You know, whether that's from your pals in the big business lobby, you know, Walmart, or even individuals. How does...
Well, the example I gave you when I was starting out talking about the enforcement against illegally harvested wood is a supply chain example. If News Corp and Bertelsmann then make it clear that they will blacklist any firm that can't guarantee them they're supplying legal wood, that has a huge effect up the supply chain, and we've actually already had requests to run compliance training courses in a number of countries for that reason. I think it's very important, and I'm actually quite struck by what Walmart is doing. For those of you who didn't see it, Walmart announced last week that they will begin labeling their products with respect to their environmental footprint. On 14 different factors, including carbon, and they will require all of their suppliers to provide the information necessary for that kind of labeling, and they expect it to exert pressure for that footprint to be reduced. For a company like Walmart, which has always said our model is just least cost, to make that shift is both an indicator of what their customers are saying and also the power of the supply chain. I think it's enormously important.
We're almost out of time. I know my colleague, Francis Moriarty, has a question. We may have room for two more. Is there one other out in the audience?
The hand over there.
Okay, so these will be the last two questions. Please make them brief. We really have a minute.
But I'm planning to filibuster, so.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. There's a lot of discussion going on here in Hong Kong with people who are talking about all this stuff. Carbon trading, et cetera, but this is really the ignorant layman's question because a lot of this I frankly don't know about and really understand. If I'm a business person in the United States and I order 10 tons of iron ore and I get 9.5 tons at the door, I know there's a problem someplace along the way. I don't understand how one actually measures with any kind of confidence what someone emitted or didn't emit or would have emitted but didn't emit, or what forest they planned to tear down, but they didn't actually tear it down. Or I tell you I plan to tear down Llama Island, but I don't do it, so give me some credits. I mean, I don't see where, because I don't understand it, I guess, but I don't see where there's an accountability and a trust mechanism here so that anybody actually knows what's being saved and what's not being saved.
So the answer to your question is different for forests and industrial carbon. So let me start out with the industrial carbon. Each plant will have a baseline. The baseline is based not actually on anybody counting emissions, because nobody's been measuring the emissions themselves. It's based on inputs. It's based on fossil fuel inputs, and then for six other gases, others. I won't go into that. And once that baseline is established, it actually isn't that difficult to demonstrate the reductions, so long as you trust that inputs are a good measure of outputs. And the scientific data showing that that's accurate is actually very good. That's what the protocol that I was talking about that we worked on with WBCSD does, is talk about how that's done. That will be regulated fairly heavily. If you went to PwC and talked to them about that now, they're getting ready for a whole line of business in which they're going to be auditing carbon statements. Forests, on the other hand, are a completely different story, and your question is a very good and very scary one. So what's under consideration is that we count avoided deforestation as a reduction in CO2 emissions, that is, trees that don't get cut down. And the proposal is that that be based on a country's baseline. How fast is deforestation going on in Brazil? And then if the country can reduce deforestation below that baseline, they can sell the credits. There are just all kinds of problems with that, even given that we can use the satellites to actually measure what's going on in the forest pretty accurately. That part we can do. But we're talking about parts of the world in which there has never been a demonstration that adding money reduces deforestation, and in which corruption and forest practices are fairly closely linked. So that creates one set of problems. The second is that we found in 2005, when the Amazon was subject to a very serious drought, that in a period of about 6 months, it went from being a sink for carbon, something that gathered CO2 in and stored it, to being a source of carbon, releasing it again almost overnight. Facing those three difficulties, your question is very real, and I don't know how it's going to be answered.
You know, I've really violated the one rule of the chair, which is where it's 201, I think, or 202. So is your question, I don't mean to be brutal. I think it's very important that people who have questions have an opportunity to ask them. But could you make yours extremely brief?
Hi, Mr. Lash. I'm Kara Young. I work in the communications department at Hong Kong Baptist University. You said that your institute engages now mostly with multinationals. I wanted to ask, do you not think or do you not work with groups to educate the public, direct public, change public opinion? Because since you've said that you think legislation is the key to moving the issue forward, you know, in the U.S. you're lucky enough to have representative government. Here we don't. In China they don't. And I think, Mr. Yan, you mentioned this meeting between Secretary of Energy Chu and Wen Jiabao. Premier Wen, he made a pretty brave statement. He said to the Secretary of Energy that the central government is all for, you know, innovative technology, energy-saving technology. They're fully on board on this. But the problem is reining in those provincial authorities, getting people's livelihoods in tune with sustainable development. In China, you know, it's a matter of it's whether you eat or don't eat. I just want to ask, what about changing the mindset of the American public? Getting people, you know, you don't live in a 4,000 meter square house, drive a, you know, gas guzzling car, run your air con all the time. Are you involved in these sorts of issues? Thank you.
Well, the short answer is no. We don't actually work at the retail level. We do partner with many, many other organizations than multinationals. We don't do big public education campaigns because we think there are others who are better at that than we are.
Thank you very much for the question. And I'm sorry if I had to cut you off. And I'm sorry to keep you all a couple minutes too late. We'd all like to thank our speaker. That was really terrific.
Thank you.
This is going to be a very live issue, and it's going to come up again and again. We have a... We have a present that we would like to give our speaker, as we always do. So if you have any other questions, please come up. We're going to exchange the present now. I hope there isn't a high carbon content in this.
It looks recycled.
We give this bag to all of our speakers and take it back after they... thank you very, very much.
Great. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Could I... Hey, I've got to take a picture. Thanks.
Yeah.
We'll do this quickly. Stand
okay.
Between us.
Oh, okay. With a booty bag?
Yeah. The carbon inefficient. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for
nice to meet you.
Thank
you.
Yeah, I hope that was useful.
It was great. I enjoyed it.
Where are you off to next?
I have a meeting with Secretary.
Was that appropriate that I was kind of abrupt with? I know Keith is very insistent that we.
He's very stiff, but you can, you know, there's no. It's not written in stone.
Okay.
You
know,
sort of say.
She blew it. She went to
the floor. Yeah.
And it wasn't much of a question either. So. Whereas the other, the forest question that you asked was just a great question. You know, I mean,
No,
but that was a great question. That if you had taken 10 minutes to ask that one
question, yes,
I would have said,
thank you.
That's worth it to spend 10 minutes to ask that one question. You know what I mean? But to say, are you working on the retail level is... That was more of a surprise.
But you've got to build support for the legislation.
I understand, but...
So the residence time for CO2 is on the order of 50 years. So it's a long time for the cycle to run out. Unless you can do things on Earth that suck up carbon, like global forests or...
Stick it in my left ear of my mind.
But in terms of the cycle of temperature change...
Is this yours? Is this yours?
Temperature change will lag by...
He said I should have...
I mean, there's cycles.
Where did Dominic go? He just disappeared. Dominic!
It goes up and down. And it's a pretty precise relationship, but in terms of human lifetimes, you're not going to see temperatures going back down again. And I'm certainly. Hello.
Chairman of IPM.
Very nice to meet you.
I just one more in the car. He said we could do it. I don't know how. I don't know which one to stick it into.
You have to ask somebody.
Well,
I can do it.
You know, I think I'll be back with the chairman of my board probably in October. And Nancy will try to arrange something then. Good. Very nice to meet you. Thank you for coming today.
My company is actually headquartered in
I need one more call. How long will it be reachable in this time zone? Or I can call you in Washington.
I'm going to be here until Wednesday morning and then in Beijing.
We're leaving for ADB and we're running a retreat in Manila. Weren't you at the ADB? Yes. Weren't you at the A... What? That's it. Weren't you at the ADB USAID?
Can we do it now? Can we do it now? With this?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. The other thing is, Vermont.
Yeah.
You would be John Easton.
I do.
Yeah. Executive Vice Chairman of the ER. We're working with him now on a major event in Bangkok, Odessa, GPR, and Capital.
He and his chairman is coming back in October, so we should start thinking about something and coordinate with his office.
Yeah, we'll do a lunch. I have a question. Is it possible to have your USA mobile?
Excuse me?
Your USA mobile?
No. Yeah.
They're going to call you. But I promise not to call you. No, I know the time is. Because we're leaving for Manila. We've got this retreat. That's a shame.
Yeah, it is.